welcome Reverend Dante Stewart to the Collective Table podcast. Dante is a pastor, an author, a storyteller, theologian, activist, athlete, and so much more. In today's conversation, we explore many of these roles and what Dante wants to create in the world through his writing and his speaking. This is a lively conversation that has so much depth and movement. As a reminder, Chelsea and I invite you to read Dante's book, Shouting in the Fire, An American Epistle. And please check out his website at dantestewart.com. Again, that's dantestewart.com to find out more about him and how to engage with his work. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
All right, cool. All right, let me tell you a story. 1976. It was the fall of 1976. Some almost 20 years ago in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education gets handed all over the country. Brown versus Board of Education, the desegregation order in which the nation is like, it is unjust to have segregated schools and one must desegregate schools. Well, in that span of that time, in a small town in South Carolina in 1976, in the fall of 1976, there's a small town in South Carolina in which around 1950s, the late early 60s, there's a school in town named John Ford High School. It's a local black school. It is a school that the black kids in town went to. It's an out the way place. You know, it's not somewhere that you would like pass through. The town is actually not a place that you would pass through. The next two biggest towns is Orangeburg, South Carolina, which is also famous during the civil rights era in which there was a Orangeburg massacre that is very important in American history. And then Columbia, South Carolina, which is also, I mean, the capital of the state and also important historically for that matter. Well, in 1976, in a small town, the school has shut down. Well, a few years earlier, the black school shut down and they've integrated into the white school, St. Matthew's High. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1969, the white populous citizenry of this town decided to open their own school entitled Calhoun Academy across the railroad tracks. To paint a picture of this town is separated by a railroad during the time of enslavement so that trains could get easier in rural areas. They would put railroad cuts in those towns to help mobilize the train. That the trains in the South symbolize, you know, power and surplus and all these things, particularly to carry, this kind of, you know, enslavement and the moving of quote unquote goods to make the moving of goods a little bit easier. Well, this town, St. Matthews, is divided by a railroad cut, which was built by enslaved persons, and white people went on this other side of the railroad in 1969 to open up their own school because the court said that they had to desegregate. Mm-hmm. 1976 comes. It's the fall of 1976. It is homecoming week in 1976. And this school is now majority black at this point. The problem is that the school is majority black, but the administration is majority white. And so the school is majority black, the administration is majority white. Justice Department said that with desegregation, the school's administration has to reflect the student body population. Problem was that the school was almost 90% black, and the administration was almost exclusively all white. Principal, superintendent, guidance counselor, football coach, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. 1976 homecoming week happens. The students vote for the homecoming queen. Friday night comes, and the black girl is voted as homecoming queen. Friday night comes, halftime happens, and the administration announces that a white girl has won in their place. The game finishes, and the townspeople, the black people in the town, get together, have a meeting. Monday comes. All weekend, they've been wondering what's going to happen. Monday comes, and the first bell rings. No black students. The second bell rings, no black students. The third bell rings, no black students. This just didn't happen for one day. This didn't happen just for Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. it went on, not just for 1 week, not just for 2 weeks, not just for 3 weeks. It went on all of October, all of November, all of December, almost all of January, in which the Justice Department had to come down to the school and sort things out. The New York Times sends a reporter down to St. Matthew, South Carolina, to report on one of the most massive uprisings of students in the history of this state. And it happened in my hometown. And this is how my school became Calhoun County High School, a black school, because of everyday ordinary students who decided that their lives mattered more than the power of one group. Mm-hmm. So what a way to begin a podcast.
What a way. Thank you for sharing that. And is this, have you known this your whole life?
No. I'm working on a project right now with ESPN. And so I'm doing a lot of digging right now.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Because I like, these are the stories that as a white person, we don't hear enough of, and we need to share them.
Oh, 100. And for me, the story is so beautiful because it was a student-led movement. Mm-hmm. And not only was it a student-led movement, it was a movement that took place in the South, in a place that you would never have heard of.
Right.
It's taking place in a rural South, mm-hmm. in a quote-unquote throwaway town, a pass-through town. Mm-hmm. And in this place, there's such a rich, beautiful history, mm-hmm. of people, everyday, ordinary people, mm-hmm. taking what little they have and doing something amazing with it. And I think if one thinks about Americana, like Americana as a term, as like representative of American culture, this right here is true Americana. Hmm. It's this idea of equal citizenship, dignity, humanity, you know, and fighting for rights. And most of all, you know, believing, you know, that you matter and things like that. And so, yes, I believe those stories should be told. Indeed. Mm-hmm.
What happened? Like, why did they decide to go back? Now I'm invested. I need to know.
Oh, come on. I got to write the project. I can't give you that.
Oh, no.
It's like any good writer. Any good writer knows that the lead of a piece has to do two things. It has to grip the audience and has to keep them wanting more. So I've gripped you. I got to keep you wanting more. I can't give
Monte, you could break the news right here on the Collective Table podcast.
I have to write. No, I can't give you that. I'm sorry.
You know, your book, though, has did you have to teach yourself some of these stories? Like, is it really like you have to had to dig, or was this things that have been passed down through your family, your friends? Like, how do you come across stories like this?
Yeah. So for me, a lot of it is like passed down orally. Now, granted, I was at the game Friday and for this project. So basically, what I'm tasked to do is over the next 8 months, I'm going to be telling the Friday Night Lights version of my hometown, St. Matthew, mm-hmm. South Carolina. Basically, a black writer returns home and tells the meaning of football to a small rural town. Mm-hmm. And in that comes the part of telling the history of this one team in this one town in this one particular moment. And what's at stakes for these young kids, as someone who knows it intimately, as someone who came from the place. And even it's in some sense returning home to discover something about myself and about a place that I am from that I did not know before. Mm-hmm. So much of gathering these stories is me learning how to do investigative reporting. One of my goals over the last year is to work on like long form writing. I really want to work on like narrative journalism. I really want to like write stories that matter and feel like that I can look at a story and a piece and see the ways that I've grown as a writer. So this was a big challenge for me to say like, okay, it's one thing to write an op-ed, you know, you give 800 to 1,000 words to 1,200 words about an idea that you have, you dress it up with a very dramatic introduction, you know, you really build out your argument in the body of the piece, and then you hit your kind of, in the last part, you hit a knockout that's reflecting and weaving these pieces together in 1,200 words. That's hard for me to do as a writer because like, I'm Reverend Dante Stewart. So I'm like long-winded. I'm a preacher, you know, and my mind, like I'm a scenic writer. So as a scenic writer, you have to really make decisions about like your first, like 100 words. They got to stick. And you got to be okay, like, letting things go in the writing, you know, and things like that. So you basically have to be like Mark. You can't be like Luke. All right. Luke, you know, you can explain the narrative, give the historical background, all these things, give the scene work, et cetera, right? And tell the whole story of, take, for example, tell the whole story of Jesus in the wilderness when he's tempted after the baptism of Jesus, he goes into the wilderness, he's tempted by Satan, et cetera. All this happened, this whole conversation takes place between Satan and Jesus. And Jesus comes out in Luke chapter 4, Jesus says, I come to preach. All right, I done went through all this, I come to preach. Mark, on the other hand, simply says this, that after Jesus was baptized, he was led into the wilderness by the Spirit to be tempted by Satan and the wild beast, and the angels were waiting on him. That was it, literally.
Yeah.
Dot, 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 dot. Right. You know, so Luke, Mark would have made a great op-ed editor, writer. Luke, on the other hand, he's done really good investigative reporting work. He's taking the real life experience of other people. He's really doing his due diligence to make sure he get it right and factual. And he's done an amazing, amazing job of weaving it together, of literally, you get the stakes of, now I'm talking in word of stakes because like my editors have been talking in this language of, if you want to write a good, really good piece, you got to first have that character where something that is at stakes for that person. Yeah. So Luke would have made a great investigative reporter or writer, a long form narrative writer, because from the jump, he says, hey, Theophilus, this is what's at stake in this letter. This is what's at stake for me. This is what's at stake for him. And this is how we're going to fill this out. So for me, going back home, it meant that first I had to kind of like, you know, research a lot about my town, in which I there was so much that I didn't know by simply typing in, you know, St. Matthews or history of St. Matthews or Calhoun County High School or St. Matthews High or this or that. And then trying to find like keywords, because like my story is about football. And like the lives of young Black boys and their families and just their lives as they live it and how they understand their stories. And many of the great football players that came through this town who played either professional or on the D1 level, and just, you know, how much football means for these kids and meant for me. But then the more that I started to like research and write, I began to realize that, okay, I need to ask a lot more questions of a lot more people. So it's simple. It's as simple as like being courageous of like, hey, y'all, I'm working on this story. Are you willing to talk to me? And then taking time to like really listen and willing to stay long enough for people to not be comfortable with you until they can get like comfortability with you to share kind of things. And sometimes it's like spontaneous where people share things and you just kind of have to like turn on a recorder or try and like remember as best you can, you know, what they've shared. That's a long way to answer what you asked about how did you get that information. It's basically research and asking questions.
There was so much in there. My mind was like, okay, I got to ask this. One, I'm just so curious to get your take on, I have my husband and I have some kids here and they love football. So when I started to read your book and you start out with Clemson, I'm like, okay, this could be something that my husband digs into. So I'm just so curious to see where you are with sports and with football and what that has meant for you and how that has evolved and or changed. Yeah. Not sure you want to go into that topic, but
I would love to. Yeah, of course. Like, yo, I mean, I'm a football player and I played it at for many people, I played it at the highest level. You know, to play at somewhere like Clemson, you know, of course I didn't play in the NFL. You know, that's the highest of the high, but that's a rarity. Like that's very, very rare. You know, of all the kids who play football, of all the places all over the country, only 56 on 32 teams make it to the league, and maybe like 12 to 14 on the practice squad, give or take. So it's like, you know, you're looking at somewhere between like, you know, 70 players on 32 teams out of all the kids who are playing everywhere, dreaming of just being in this one spot, you know. So it has been a blessing to play ball and to be a football player and to, you know, and to own it, you know, to own. One of the things in this season I feel like God is teaching me is to own my story, is to own who I am. You know, coming from my hometown, just to give a couple of demographical stats, you know, and to be careful not to make a trope out of, you know, the place that I came from. You know, the area that I came from, you know, it exists in what many politicians in the 90s and the 2000s called the Corridor of Shame. It's a place, it's a strip of area in South Carolina that has been left behind financially, resource-wise. You know, many of the opportunities are cut off. I mean, you're talking about the education rates are drastically behind. So like one in six has a bachelor's degree, you know, in this town, you know. So it's like many of the opportunities ain't there. You got to drive, you know, 20 minutes to get to the nearest hospital, you know, or if depending on where you live, you know, you got to drive like 25 minutes to the nearest hospital or something like that. So, you know, where I'm from, you know, there's not much there. And it's like, you know, coming from this area where opportunities are so little, and then you're not even talking about like the violence that's associated with that, whether it's kind of social violence, you know, that is wrought and woven into the environment that you are in based on the limited choices that people have, or you think about the actual real legitimate, like physical and material violence that people go through by things that's like taken away, whether that's life, opportunities, time, you know, goods, loved ones, et cetera, et cetera, you know, health, all of those things that are taken away, material, physical, literal things that are taken away. And part of like thinking about like football is also me owning where I came from and like the gift of what that made me. You know, you go off to somewhere like Clemson, part of being able to do well at Clemson or any really to go off to school for that matter is there's a part of you that like remembers but also forgets. And so to be a young Black boy in the South, there's a part of like forgetting that kind of dislodges you from the true real reality and lived experiences that you had. So it's like, you know, you made it out and that was a part of your past, you know, with not realizing that, like, you know, that's also a part of your present. And it informs how you think about the world, it informs how you walk in the world, et cetera, no matter how much you forget about it or try and dislodge yourself from it. So like in this season of life, I've been really like owning, you know, the beauty, the gift, you know, the hardship of being a Black boy in South Carolina, from that area, making it playing football and then having a really good time at Clemson and really good career, but also, you know, the very hard part of what happens when you have to walk away. And I think that's been the, you know, as I think about my own football career, because it was a meteoric rise, you know, what I was able to do as a football player, which I really didn't even get into in my book, what I was able to do as a football player going from, you know, being a really, really good player in high school, playing an all-star game to not signing for signing day because I believed that I should play on D1 level. Even though I had offers on D1 AA, I had this belief that Dante belonged on D1 1A. You know, I belong with the big dogs. And that's part of where I come from. You know, it's the belief that like, hey, bro, if I'm gonna play the game, bro, I want to go for the gusto. You know, I want to go for the highest of the high of the high. So we're shaped that way. So I'm like, you know, what I did was special because, like, you know, I decided not sign. And I went to walk on at Clemson. After walking on, got put on scholarship, ended up starting that corner, playing. And then I had a meteoric fall, you know, when it came to, like, a situation happened where, you know, just a tough situation. I wasn't mentally strong and I left and went to West Carolina. And 5-6 games into the season, I quit football altogether. And came back to Clemson to get my degree. So over the years, it has been incredibly hard, you know, to make sense of my own relationship with football. You know, because like every player, it takes a good 2 years, you know, 2 or 3 years, especially if you play at that high level. Yeah. It takes a good, like 2 or 3 years to kind of adjust to this like new normal. And it takes about 5 to 6 years to be able to process everything that happened. And then by the time you get to that eighth, ninth, tenth year, and you settle into, you know, your reality, you're able to really reflect on it with wisdom. And I think right now, as I'm in that like 10th year of being gone, I've been able to really enjoy football more. I mean, I've been enjoying football more, but I mean like actually being willing to visit some places in my relationship with football that I wasn't able to, you know, emotionally or even as a writer, visit them before. Actually, what's crazy is like, I think like next week, I think it's coming out next week. My first piece with ESPN is coming, where I wrote a piece on, it's a football story, where I wrote about the decade. So the time that I quit football in 2013 to the January in 2023 when I was diagnosed with my mental health disorders and everything in between, all of the forgetting, all of the remembering, all of, you know, the triumph, all of the trials, all of the beauty, all of the curse of this game called football. And I felt I'm actually extremely proud of that essay because, you know, I dug deep and I went places that oftentimes football players aren't allowed to go, especially Black men, you know, talking about like mental health and really honestly talking true about like what we feel and what's taken away. And to speak honestly about this game of football and like everything it gives us and also everything it just robs us of.
Where will we be able, I'd love to be able to promote that because I know so many, I know people, my family who would love to read that. And I think you've touched on a lot of really important elements for young men who are playing these sports, especially football. And so is that, will that be available for?
Oh yeah. Facts. It's going to be out. We in the last ride.
Okay, great.
I've been working on this joint for like 2.5 months too. It's been like, God, it's been crazy. I'm ready for it to get out in the world. We almost done though,
okay,
so it should be out. It's going to be out, and
okay.
I'll make sure y'all get it.
Okay. Does your son play football?
No, but though my son's 5 years old, so
okay.
I mean, one of the things I want to get him in is like karate and t-ball and things like that. And I mean, I may let him play like flag football or something like that because my son is like actually incredibly athletic. My wife was All-State, All-Star in softball, you know, a really good basketball player. So we both of his pedigree is just like shot through with like athleticism just like intuition. And so even at 5 years old, I could tell that like, okay, this kid is like real athletic, like as a young, and he's like daring and courageous. And that, you know, that's just, you know, intuition plus courage can turn anybody great, you know, whether you're in business, whether you're in preaching, you know, whether you're in writing, you know, That is the marks of greatness. Intuition plus courage, baptized in endurance. That makes a great person, a great human being. So we got to work on that that patience and endurance part. But he has the intuition and the courage part right now. And I have a complicated relationship with that question about like, you know, will he play? Or I actually wrestled with that in the piece. About ESPN.
Yeah, I just think about the.
To you, I'm a person. I got to give you the cliffhanger. I can't give you an answer that I.
No, don't. I mean, I just want to be able to promote the piece because it just sounds like an amazing. Like you're touching on some serious topics here that I think resonate with a lot of people, even if they're not sharing them. And so I just want to make sure it gets out.
I was asking that question about football because, and this conversation took a turn from where we thought it was going to go. But thinking about football.
I'm sorry.
No, you're good. But just thinking of the almost the violent nature of football and how we are consumers of this sport that isn't necessarily good for the players that are playing it. And Dana have had some recent conversations with football kind of back just about what does that mean? And, you know, I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
I got a complicated relationship with it because for me, like, I think from a scientific standpoint, we got to be real. Like, yo, hey, bro. Like, I was this is actually in the piece as well. You know, I wrestle with this. It's like, at the end of the day, none of us, you know, go unscathed, you know, who play the game. Mentally, emotionally, psychologically, physically. So you got to think about it. To play football at the level that many of us play football, you almost have to have a sort of control mania in order about you. You know, you have to really, you know, this has to be something about you that's just different, that turns on a switch that is not meant to be turned off, in which you will do whatever you can to either bring this person down, even if it's at the detriment of yourself. I mean, I'm talking about like, thankfully there's rules now on the game that where one can get like a penalty for like targeting, you know, hitting somebody with the crown of your head. Yep. You know, if you think about it, like, I mean, that's a very dangerous hit. Like if you hit somebody with the crown of your head, not only can you like really injure them, like you can really paralyze yourself because basically you collapse and like it's not normal. It's not a normal, like tackling isn't a normal thing for the human body to do, like bending over playing corner, for hours upon hours ain't a normal thing for the body to do to like, you know, it's just, it's, but also on the flip side, like people won't understand it. You won't understand it unless you play it, and if you ain't played it, it's hard to understand it. Like, you know, I get the conversation about like, yo, football is violent and things like that. But I personally don't think that. I mean, it's just a part of it. You know, it's like, it's a part of the game. You know, people get hurt. You know, it's a part of like, you know, yeah, I hate to sound like morbid about it, but like, you know, it just is what it is in that regard. And we do what we got to do, you know, to protect yourself and things like that and protect other people. But you just got to be a different cat to play the game. And I don't look at it as violence as much as I look at it as a game that we're playing, and you know, we love it. And you just can't understand it unless you play it. Like you can't. Yeah, when you in the field and like when you're in the game and you're thinking about like, you know, the ball snaps, the stadium goes quiet, your breath, like your heart rate is almost like through the roof, and like, but everything slows down, and you know, you're guarding a receiver and you can tell that like, yo, he ain't about to go for a pass. This is a run. You get up under his shoulder pass, you rip him off, you jerk him. You see the running back coming towards you and you're like, hey, for me as a corner, like I ain't really like hitting like that. I ain't going to be nobody that's going to bang you, you know? So it's like, and then like everything speeds up and you make the tackle. And then like you hear like the roars and like you see your teammates' eyes and you stare into one another's eyes. And they like, you get this energy, this rush of energy that's just like unexplainable. And like you're like beating your chest. And then they come up beside you and they hit you on your helmet. And then it's the next play again. Yeah. Like that, the only word that is as close to that experience that one can think of is magic. And like, it's hard to call like magic violence when like it turns you into a better human being. It gives you access to something that you wouldn't have access to had you not played this game. So,
yeah. And it's so I am not the competitive person, although I'm around a bunch of competitive people in my family. And so I love the words that you're using to describe that. And yet I wonder, having that feeling, making sure that the individuals that are that passionate and have that athletic ability are taken care of. And that's what, I mean, I think the NFL is doing a better job, but I often worry that, you know, are these players really cared for, even that they're putting themselves on the line, that there's crowds yelling their name. Are we making sure those players have lifetime care?
Oh, 100%. Now that's a conversation that I think like legit, like, that's the conversation that needs to really happen. It's like, there's one part of the game, like playing the game, but then there's also the part of care.
Right.
You know? And I think from the standpoint of like, say like the NCAA or the NFL, care is almost like in response to like something happening. So a player gets hit and you get a penalty. So right. Like, okay, we care for this kid who got targeted by giving this other kid a penalty and ejection out of the game.
Right.
So we're not saying that like, yo, y'all can play the game, that penalty is there as well, and you got lifetime insurance. So I think that's a more important conversation, which is why for me, like, it's kind of a sad thing as well, because I mean, many of these conversations are happening now, but like thousands of athletes done played the game and like, the damage has already been done.
Right. Yeah.
And can't go back and repair that damage that has already been done. You just a part of an unfortunate telling of events that fell by chance.
Yep.
And that is the emotional part, weight that I carry with myself as I think about like either athletes who've committed suicide, athletes who've committed heinous crimes against other people because they lost their minds.
Yep.
You know, athletes who, you know, go into deep dives of depression and personality disorder because, you know, the switch that you're able to turn on, you can't turn it off because, like, your brain chemistry has been literally rewired because of where you at, you know? So it's like, that's like a deep sentimental spot in my heart, especially as someone who played the game and who now has the language of thinking about the human body and the psyche and the human soul and society and healthcare and legality and things like that. Like, you know, I bear that weight on my own soul because I know that, like, for the thousands of kids who will be cared for because of the changes that, like, athletes themselves have made, there are, like, hundreds, maybe thousands who will not. And the corporate of that care has been, like, not because we care so much for you, therefore we want to create the right conditions. No, it's been in response to, okay, this dude put a gun to his temple,
right?
Blew his brains out.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what happened. When right. in actuality, like, he was showing signs the whole time. Or, you know, this person is really struggling with finding a job, you know, transitioning, because the unfortunate truth is that, like, you know, you really ain't got time when you're playing ball, you know, to really, if you're being honest, you don't really got time to, like, explore other options. And so, like, the care is not like, I mean, those guys before, it's just an unfortunate situation. So you just kind of try and do what you can, you know, to make life better for somebody else who's playing the game right now, and do as best you can to care for those who played the game back then who don't have access to the same opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a good conversation.
How did you start writing? Like, what was your catalyst to start that art form?
Shoot, I wish I knew. I ain't gonna lie. Like, I've been actually, what's interesting is I've actually legitimately been trying to figure out, Chelsea, where that came from. Like, I talk to my mom, and my mom would tell me that, like, you know, that I was, like, a poet back then. Now, back to my mental health diagnosis. One of the diagnoses was CPTSD. And if anybody knows anything about CPTSD, one of the things is that it, like, you remember only in fragments. So the part of the brain that stores memories, it becomes altered and changed. And sometimes suppressed, sometimes it vanishes altogether. And so for me, like, I can only think of my life in fragments. There are moments in my life. I mean, if you would have asked me, like, you know, where were you at 16? I could piece some things together, but not really. Where were you at 21? I could piece some things together, but not really. Where were you at 24? You know, I'll have to look at you, have to give me some pictures and let me try and travel back in time. So, like, when people ask me how I became a writer, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell that story because, you know, sometimes I actually don't remember. Like, I remember as a young kid that, like, you know, I always loved poetry. And I was, like, this football player, this athlete who loved to write poetry. I was an artist. I loved to draw. I would go to art school in the summer times. And me and my sister, Dominique, would go into art school in Orangeburg that my mom would have us in and things like that. And, like, you know, I always loved, like, drawing. Even in college, like, I wrote, like, poems and actually wrote, like, a poetry collection and gave it to a teacher. And I don't even know where it's at. I don't even know what. Like, my mom reminds me of, like, this happening. And I faintly remember that happening, but I have no access to any of those poems from back in college. I would literally love to have access to that because, you know, college was just a very, like, you know, for me, it was just such a tough time. Like, it was a beautiful, but it's also a tough time. And I wonder what that kid was like, you know, at 18, 19, 20, 21. Like, what was he... Like, what drove that kid to the poem? Like, what was it that did it? Like, why did he write poems? But yeah, like, as a youngin' and even in college, I would always, like, turn to poems. And I think for me, what got me really started was in 2013 when I quit football at Western Carolina. My wife had went off to the military. She went off into the military, and I'll show y'all something I never showed before. Y'all getting something that I've literally never showed anybody this. So my wife went off to the military. Better show you some desperation in practice. So my wife went off to the military, and she was at basic training for 2.5 months. It was in November that she went off to the military. I think it was November 23rd that she left, for some time around then. By that time, I had already quit football, had already left kind of everything behind, and made the decision I was going to go back to Clemson. And I was living in a one-bedroom apartment up above on a hill where you could see over the campus of Cullowhee in Cullowhee, North Carolina. You could see the clock tower that rears above everything. You could see the top of the stadium and things like that. Like, almost every day I would, like, you know, either walk or drive to campus. I can't remember whether I drove or walked. You know, whether I drove or walked, whether I still had my black 96 Honda Accord at that time or not. I don't think I did, but I can't remember. But I remember, you know, just how at that time, how hard it was to wrestle with the reality that I was, like, actually done with football. Like, there's a part of me that didn't want to believe it, because in a span of 3 months, you know, here I was in Clemson having the time of my life. And in a span of 3 months, here I am in a one-bedroom apartment alone by myself, going from one room to the next, you know, standing up, sitting down, you know, going, laying down, playing a video game, opening my computer, trying to do schoolwork, can't focus, going back, laying down, crying. I was in this, like, it's a miracle that I survived that moment, because it was such a hard moment. Well, when she went off the basic training, I made a promise to myself. I don't even know why I did this, but it just felt so life-giving in that moment. I made a promise to myself that every day I would write her, every single day. I would open up my computer, and I would write her every single day, because she was the only person I felt could understand me, like, who could understand what I was trying to be as a human, what I was trying to prove, what I felt was, like, taken away. And at that moment when she left for basic training, I felt like, you know, the thing that mattered to me most was, like, taken away. You know, I was used to being around. I was used to seeing her. And I was put in this place of desperation and loneliness that I don't think any kid, you know, deserves to be in. You know, one day you playing football and you guarding receivers and, like, you know, you talking about your dreams and you're doing it all as a way to kind of cope with the guilt and the shame and the regret of leaving somewhere like Clemson and going to Western Carolina. You know, you sprinkling, like, some Jesus in there, and, you know, you trying to, like, you know, go to Bible study and church, and you latching on all these things to, like, make sense of, like, how in the world did I get here? And so every day I sat down and I would write single page letters to my wife. This one is dated. This is actually dated December. I pulled out a random one. This is dated December 31st, 2013. It's the day before, it's New Year's Eve. And I'm talking about, like, my memories and all the things that, like, I was going through and all the things I wanted. I went back in time and began to tell her about, like, you know, like, the way we met and, like, what I wanted and what I desire. And like, there's this line. Then we went right on into spring practice, and you visited me and encouraged me so much. Now let's go to the spring game. The night before, two nights before, we had our spring gospel concert, and you came to support me. We were fresh as a couple, too. You had on a beautiful black and white chevron dress that I love. And I had on a black blazer with my white V-neck. It was great to have you there. And, like, I feel like at that moment is where I learned how to intimately, like, chronicle the details of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I learned without even going to class scene and setting and detail and intention. I learned, like, narrative arc, how to start a thing, how to start a story and begin it.
Yeah.
I learned how to, you know, create believable characters who are oftentimes complex and confused about life, who want so much and who feel like everything is being taken away. And you see, you know, like, this young man who is reaching for everything, who's writing letters. And I timestamped these letters. One is at, this letter is written at 12:41. Another letter is written at like 8:13. Another letter is written at 9:38 p.m. Another one is written at 5:14 in the morning. So here is this kid at all times of the day returning to the safest place he knows, and that's the page. And like all the writing that I've learned, if you can begin in desperation and end in empathy, then you can have really good writing. And when I look back at these letters, I realized that both desperation and empathy was woven in every page. And over the years, as life began to get tougher, and life did get tougher, you know, that's 2013. So much has happened in my life since that moment. People have died. I've gone through things. I've gone through health challenges. I've gone through mental health challenges. I've gone through life challenges. I've gone through my son having a seizure. I've gone through losing my losing family members. I've gone through almost losing my wife in childbirth. And yet, over and over again, I've gone through, you know, seeing a dead body, you know, in front of me, a half split dead body, you know, in front of me. I've gone through like what many Black people have gone through, seeing Black people die on camera, and seeing people that, you know, you entrust yourself to, you know, turn on you and betray you. And yet through all those moments, I realized that I return again and again and again and again and again and again and again to the place where I began as a young kid, through high school, through college, all the way in adulthood, to the page. And it seemed to be the safest place. And for me, I think that's the beginning of how I would think about, you know, how I became a writer.
Yeah.
Almost feels like a spiritual practice.
I would say so. I think for me, it definitely is a spiritual practice, because, you know, it is me in my most vulnerable state.
Yeah.
Like, I think about, like, and you know, it's complicated too, because you would think that when people, the more people do a thing, the more courageous they become at doing it, which it just hasn't happened for me like that. Like, I thought that, like, when I became a professional writer, I began to call myself a writer, and I really set up my life to try and, like, be like, provide for my family through writing and come out with a book and, you know, write for all these types of people and things. I thought that, like, I would get better at courage, when in actuality, the opposite has happened. That, like, you know, I'm always afraid every time I sit down and write a thing, or, you know, I'm always second guessing myself and, you know, wondering if the experience that I've had is enough, or wonder if the thing I got to say is enough, or wondering if the life I've lived, you know, is a real life in which one can gain wisdom from, in which one can see, you know, so much lessons from, and things like that. You know, every time I go to the page, I wonder those things, and it's not easy. And yet, like, for me, it's the place I am vulnerable, because much like being a minister, being Reverend Dante Stewart, like, the whole idea of being a reverend is simple, and yet not simple, but it is simple. It's simply this, like, it's going to the place that people find it hard to go, to be on the other side and lead them safely through. That's simply what it means to be a minister. From birth to death, and every moment in between. That's simply what it means to be. When you open up your Bible every single day, you're going to the place in your study that people find it hard to go. And you turn around to lead them safely through on the other side. When you study the Bible and you have to go through like all your exegetical work, and, you know, you got to go through all your things to, you know, really get a good sermon that people are going to walk away from and feel inspired and challenged and gifted with something that they didn't have. You know, many people find it hard to go there because, you know, they don't have time, no interest, or, you know, the Bible, you know, is a book that just has been traumatic for them, or, you know, they misused and things like that. That's simply our job, is to go to the place people find it hard to go. As a writer, you know, people, as I've not seen black male writers who play football at a high level write about depression, you know, or write about CPTSD, or write about football in ways that implicate me in the story, you know, and that's, I haven't seen that. So I have to go there. You know, I haven't seen a black writer who's a Christian who can name what happened in the white evangelical space as I've done in the fire and implicate myself in that story. And to say that truth is the beginning of liberation. And on the other side of that, we find everything we've been looking for to be who we are, that God created us to be. And I read a whole ton of books. I read a lot of books. I read a lot of books. I just haven't seen anybody go to that place and name it and say that, okay, let's be real. I became something that I should not have become. And it became a weapon to other people, and they used it, and I used it. And I provide, and it was a damaging, horrifying thing. And we all became things that we didn't want to be. And yet, I changed. Don't see no book. Y'all, trust me, I read a lot of memoirs. Like I read a whole lot to write Shouting in the Fire. And even as I'm working on my second book, which we just finished a proposal. We actually going out with it this week to sell the next book. I feel good about it. I've been reading a whole bunch for this next book, you know, and it's just like, you know, God is, I guess it's a certain grace, you know, that God puts on your life to be able to like do that work of going where people feel they can't go and just leading them safely through it. It's, I don't even know what the question was. So.
Well, you know, in Shouting in the Fire, you talk about your faith journey, and I'm curious, where are you now with your faith journey? Where is it?
Oh, yeah. I'm Reverend Dante Stewart. Was ordained in December under Reverend Dr. Charles E. Goodman here at the Tabernacle Baptist Church in Augusta, Georgia, at 1223 Laney Walker Boulevard, Augusta, Georgia, 30901, I think. 30901 here in Augusta, Georgia. I'm actually the TAB Global Digital Minister here. I'm in the church. Like, I'm a reverend. I'm in ministry.
Yeah.
I'm very much, I'm preaching this Sunday, actually. I'm preaching Sunday at the 10:30 service. So I'm very much in ministry. And I love the church. You know, for me, you know, I there is a part of the church that just holds a special place in my heart, you know, as a thinker, as a leader. You know, people do leave the church, and it's okay. And I think people should be able to do that. You know, everybody who left Jesus didn't leave Jesus because they hated him. And they didn't leave him because they found him hard, you know, to deal with. I think that's been a very deep misconception in the way we read the Bible. It's like, oh, they left Jesus because they didn't want to like mess with him. Maybe they left Jesus because of some other reasons that we are may not privy to. And they should be able to do that. And who's to say that they actually, that the writer who chronicled them leaving actually saw it the way that they saw themselves. Maybe they were just taking a break. Maybe they were actually just going to go get some food. Maybe they were just, you just don't know. It's like, those writers are human too. And so like, people should be able to do that. And yet for me, I'm a church boy at heart, and something in my kind of human ecosystem would be off if I was not tied to the Lord's church. That's actually a hard thing to walk out. I ain't gonna lie, because it's like, you know, I'm writing in public, you know, and I'm a minister in the church, you know, so it's like I'm on stage every Sunday, you know, in the church. And, you know, throughout the week, it's like I'm trying to do this work of like ministering to the larger world. Mm-hmm. And it's a tough thing to do because, you know, ministering to the world is filled with the evangelical echo chamber right now. And the evangelical echo chamber is a very loud and powerful reality. You know, who's to say that I couldn't climb up in that chamber if I would have stayed there? I'm a very charismatic dude. I'm like, you know, I know how to galvanize people. You know, I know, you know, how to talk. I know how to preach. I know how to, you know, be funny. I know how to do this. And, you know, had I stayed in an evangelical church, who knows where, like, you know, a sort of quote unquote, like, metaphorically speaking, your star rising. Who knows, you know, where that would have gone, especially with, you know, how much influence the evangelical church has in social media and print media and public media, et cetera, et cetera. And yet changing and being like thanking God for that change and not being in that space and not wanting that type of power for myself, you know, it's a hard thing to walk out, because when you step out into the world as a Christian, you're always judged against like the good or the bad people perceive evangelicals doing. And it makes it incredibly hard, because once, you know, you start talking about the Bible and questioning it and giving people space to feel and to think and preaching things in different ways and, you know, quoting different books and things like that, you know, people oftentimes would rather listen to what feels safe rather than, you know, going on a journey with their faith that will make their faith better. And it just makes it a challenge. And yet, you know, God, I guess God is just, that's the lot that God has given your boy that I'm just trying to walk out.
And, you know, and I've followed your writing just on Instagram for a while and the book. And so it's surprising to me for you to talk about, because I find you to be such a courageous writer, and the way that you talk about things in politics and current events and the ways in which in the book you were able to go back and look at your childhood parts that were really painful. And it's like courage and vulnerability just like seep through in your work so beautifully. And so it's surprising to hear you say that, because I would name you courageous and vulnerable in the same breath also.
Thank you. That's real. I mean, I would say that that's true. I ain't going to flex. Like, I think courage is a muscle. It's like Maya Angelou.
Yeah.
She believed that courage was the most important thing, that without courage, none of the virtues that she write can be practiced, you know, well. And I believe that. I truly, truly believe that, like, you know, my courage has been built out of heartbreak. Yeah. Like, the only reason why I'm able to be courageous about who I am and the life I've lived is because I've been so heartbroken in life and I've dealt with it. And I've at least been willing to go there and process. And therefore, you know, I'm able to at least write about it in some way, you know? So it's like, yeah, that is very true. That is actually who I am. And yet I'm not always aware of it when I'm actually doing the thing, because on the one hand, it's like, I'm a football player. So you got to realize that, like, when I step on the scene, like, I'm made for the lights. I want a big life. Like, it just is what it is. I've been created for a big life. I want a big life, and I intend to win, and I intend to write well, and I intend to do all these things. And yet there's also the flip side of it, that, like, just like being a football player, you know, sometimes your audacity, you know, is far beyond where your skill set actually is. And you got to figure out how to bridge the gap between those things. So therefore, when you actually get to the work, you're not always aware of your courage, because that's not the thing you feel most intimately and intensely. You really feel how vulnerable you are, and you just got to find a way to keep on chugging and pushing through, no matter what.
Well, and you said when you sit down to write, when you sit down to, you know, write, you have a fear, you have an uncertainty. And I'm wondering if that's just a part of the process. Like, I wonder if that's a good thing. Like, it forces you to, does it force you to kind of dig deeper, to be more thoughtful, to really keep that growth mindset going? Like, you want to be better. You want to strive. And so that it helps.
Oh, 100%. Like, yeah. Like, cause for me, like, and I get this from my bro, Jason, my big bro, Jason Reynolds, like, yo, like, if you want to be good at a thing, you're going to have to practice. Like, even him, like, he has a lifetime achievement award at 39 years old, like, in literature, like, at 39, fam. Like, and this bro, like, his phone be silenced and he be in the grind. He be in the doghouse working and getting better and growing himself. And I think, like, that's just, like, so important. It's like, you know, you just got to keep trying at it. You got to, because it just don't happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that is that the tough part is, like, you learn and work much more harder than a lot of people learn and work. And yet you feel no more equipped than those people who don't work at all.
Yeah. Because, that's a great reflection.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Because the more you read, the more you know, It's like, dang, bro, that the more you feel like how far the distance is between you and those people. So I'm over here like, dang, bro, I can't like write like Ocean Vuong. You know, I can't write like Ocean. I can't write like Jackie Woodson. You know, I can't write like, you know, Wright Thompson and Kiese Layman and Jasmine Ward. All of these people, like some of my favorite writers. I'm like, and yet, you know, because I show up and practice every day and things like that, it's like, I mean, I'm going to get there and I'm going to keep trying. And if I don't, you know, wherever I am, I'm going to try as best I can to love where I am and realize that, like, at the end of the day, like, my mind says there's no writer better than me. And I believe that. And I'm just going, that's just the athlete in me. You know, it just is. I love the Lord, you know, I love the Lord, but I'm a dog. I'm a competitor. I'm a competitor. So.
You know. Well, Dante, we're on the journey with you because we're looking out for the next Dante Stewart publication, article, book, whatever you got. We're ready for it. So,
well, yeah, I got a lot of stuff coming. Like I really got some good stuff coming, and I'm very proud. I'm proud of myself and proud of the people around me, because I mean, ever since one of my best friends died in 2021. You know, I've been going through some of the hardest years of my life. And it's just been tough. It's been tough emotionally. And a lot of people have had to hold me over these last few years that in ways that are unseen, but so powerful and necessary. And yet I'm proud of myself that at those moments at 4:30 in the morning when nobody's watching, or those moments at 5 o'clock when nobody's watching, Dante Stewart is up. And he's writing and he's going, and he took L's. I took some major L's over these last years, you know, and rejections and trying again and failing again and trying again and feeling better, like Samuel Beckett says in that short story. And yet I'm so proud of, you know, myself and the people who made me, because without them, you know, whatever life I've been able to build at 31 years old, none of it would be possible. And yet without me, none of this would be actionable. None of this would have happened.
No.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you for not only your time with this hour and being so open and vulnerable with us, sharing with us so much, but just for the work that you put into the world. It has blessed us, and we know that it will bless people that are listening to this and that will continue to follow you. And so, we just encourage you to continue being courageous, continue being vulnerable, continue being yourself. It's really a gift.
Yeah. Oh, amen. Amen.
And thank you, each of you, for this time and this space, and to each of your guests who constantly pay attention and show you love and you make the audience real to you.